You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Here today, joined by a few dozen little jars of spices blended by Lior Lev Sirkars.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you doing? I'm going to let you actually say the name of your business so I don't butcher it.
The name of the business is La Boite, which means the box, and it's home for La Boite à Biscuit, which is the cookie box, and La Boite à Épices, which is the spice box.
Yeah, and where are you located, up near Columbus Circle?
I'm at 724 11th Avenue, so 11th Avenue and 51st.
Yeah, so all the way over in
Hell's
No Man's
Kitchen.
Land.
Yeah. Hell's Kitchen, yeah.
But in Hell's Kitchen, Lior blends some of the most fantastic spices for a lot of chefs around the city and around the world.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you grew up kind of international, born and raised in Israel, as you wrote to me, a small kibbutz in the Galilee, then lived in Rome and Brussels. Do you remember what you ate during your childhood? What kind of food was surrounded you?
Yeah, of course I remember a lot. I mean, growing up in a kibbutz, which isn't the biggest food scene out there.
Yeah.
but Israel, generally speaking, is a very interesting place as far as food goes. The combination of Eastern European, North African, Persian, even Latin cuisine, Yemenite, everything combined into such a small place creates a very unique cuisine.
Yeah.
And then growing up in places like Rome, and then Brussels was also very interesting,
yeah,
the exposure.
And what age were you in Rome and Brussels?
Oh, I was very young.
Yeah.
In Rome, I was about a year old,
yeah,
for about a year or so. But then Brussels, I was already 7, 8 years old for about 4 years. So I was more aware of what I was eating, and I was exposed to things that, as a regular child in Israel, let's put it that way,
yeah.
I wouldn't have the chance. I think having a Chateaubriand at the age of 7 was a big moment,
yeah,
I think, in my career.
But did you take certain things from your, you know, rearing in Israel with you to Rome and Brussels?
I was too young to. I didn't cook at that point.
Yeah,
but it's interesting. As a child, I mean, we never ate kids' food, which is something that I still have a hard time understanding on menus.
Yeah, chicken fingers.
I don't know, just kids' meal in general. We ate what my parents ate.
Yeah.
And fortunately enough for me and my sisters, my parents liked eating. So we just ate whatever they ate, and I think that was a big advantage.
Yeah. And your first taste of cooking wasn't until you actually joined the military.
It was a bit earlier. My mom worked until pretty late, and I remember a lot of phone calls in the afternoon, like, I'm going to run late.
Yeah.
So can you just grab a few things and make dinner?
Yeah.
And I think that was the first experience with my younger sister. We were both really into cooking and just grabbing stuff and reading cookbooks. And then obviously the military has many of you know, the Israelis. I was a sergeant, and I had to, you know, be in charge of the cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they didn't show up, or they were sick or whatever, and I found myself cooking.
Yeah, what kind of cuisine were you making?
It's basically heat and send. That's the term. You just heat whatever you have you just send it out and hope for the best.
Peel the foil off. And
And sitting in some hostile countries with a little, like, a fuel cook stove or cooktop, and just cooking for 200 people in the middle of nowhere was an interesting experience.
Yeah. So, I mean, was everything bland? Did you ever find yourself interjecting spices to maybe, you know...
Not at that point.
Yeah.
No, that was a bit later on. Yeah.
Because after the army...
Uh-huh.
Seems kind of random, but started working for a small trout smoking business.
Well, I had to make some money. I didn't know exactly what I... And I, the kibbutz where I was born, one of the special things about it, they have a very big fish farm industry.
Yeah.
So that wasn't something that was new to me, trouts and things like that. And with another person from that area, we kind of started a small place of trout smoking and trout products.
Yeah, what kind of products did you make?
It was basically whole grilled or whole baked trouts that were then frozen and sent all over the countries to restaurants that did not have cooking facilities, so they can only microwave or heat in the oven.
And you've lived that life before in the military.
I lived that life before, so then I had to think of a person home that wanted to serve a great smoked trout or a great grilled trout, but didn't want to cook it.
Yeah.
Just want to warm it up. So it was an interesting experience, definitely.
Yeah, and how long were you doing that for?
About a year and a half, doing anywhere from, I'd say, 600 pounds to 1,500 pounds a day of trouts.
Yeah.
Which is very large quantities.
Yeah, and... After, you know, a good 18 months of smoking fish, what was your next move?
I went away for about a year trip to South America, and I basically did nothing much except for spending time in markets, cooking for friends of mine who were hiking and doing a lot of physical activities that I wasn't really into. I was just waiting at the end of the day and say, when you come back, I'll cook something.
Yeah, that seems like a good goal, though, to come back and have a home-cooked
meal.
Exactly.
So I was fishing for trout in places like Argentina or Chile, and, you know, I had a fishing rod and just cooked whatever was around. And it was a year of a lot of fun, a lot of cooking, a lot of new ingredients that I was never exposed to before.
Like which ones?
Like some dried potatoes in Peru that are dried in high altitude, in order to preserve them for the rest of the year. So they're only in season for a little while, and then so they dry them, and then they hydrate them again in seasons throughout the year. And a lot of chilies, a lot of different kind of corns, things like that, the arepas in Colombia, and things like that. Fresh coconut that, you know, I never got to eat or cook with.
Yeah.
Especially in Colombia. So I came back with a lot of very interesting ideas about cooking, and basically had to get another job. And cooking was something that I started liking more and more, but yet I had no experience. And every place I went to, they go like, oh, did you go to school? And I said, no. So they said, well, you could start by, you know, peeling some carrots or washing dishes, and then we'll see how it goes. And I was very fortunate to find this small catering company with basically one chef cook and another assistant. And he basically adopted me and said, I'll teach you how to cook, you know, in a very calm environment.
Yeah. And where in the world was this?
That was in Israel, in a little town called Rishon LeZion. And basically, I worked with him for 3 years doing events for up to 1,000 people, cooking on a very large scale, and cooking also outdoors. One of the biggest thing that we did there was cater events, but outdoors, so on mountains, in little valleys, near rivers, without a lot of cooking equipment. So it's the ability of how to cook outdoors yet to do great food.
Well, I mean, it's also interesting to note that a lot of people know that plain food is not as tasteful as when you're on sea level and even higher altitudes such as Denver in the United States. But that you have to interpret taste and spices and those types of senses interpreting the world around you as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was great. That was three amazing years. But I think we both, him and I, realized that I needed to do something else with my life.
Yeah.
And I moved to France. I went to the Paul Bocuse Institute in Écully, which is right outside of Lyon.
Yeah.
A beautiful castle. It's the dream school, if you can think of it.
Exactly. Can you explain a little bit about how, who Paul Bocuse is? I mean, he's a legend.
Paul Bocuse is a legend in the food culinary world. He is probably 85 years old by now. He spent all of his life basically outside of Lyon in a small restaurant that he took to the next level and got his three Michelin stars. I can't tell you if it's 30 years or probably 40 years now that the restaurant has three Michelin stars, and was one of the first chefs that basically left the kitchen and moved to the dining room to see what's happening, and really had a lot of involvement in the front of the house, and really started talking about cooking and, you know, and being a little bit the ambassador of cooks all over the world. And so basically creating for the first time another, you know, different aspects of cooks that are not just behind the stove or in the kitchen. And really maintained throughout these old years a very classic Lyonnaise cuisine, you know, throughout the whole Nouvelle Cuisine and then the fusion, and everything stayed very true to the origin and the cooking of Lyon. And also really promoting usage of, you know, local ingredients and local cuisine. You know, it's whatever is around you, just work with it, you know, and whatever is in season and whatever is also traditional, you know, and stayed really true to all of that. And is accepted, I think, by everybody worldwide as, you know, if we can say, the godfather of cuisine of the new era.
Well, I mean, he has the Olympics of cooking.
Yeah, the Bocuse d'Or.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so he was asked to give his name or to become the president, the honorary president of that school in Écully that he founded, and today is named after him, and he's always talking about his legacy. That would be him and his restaurant, which would become some sort of a museum or a culinary center once he's no longer with us. So the school is a very interesting, not only you learn how to about cooking, of course, and pastry and all these things, but it's also about management. Is, if you will, the equivalent of what the CIA does upstate New York, and they do have an exchange program between them in the last 5 or 6 years. So that's very interesting. What they also do the same way as the CIA is they basically have you do 2 6-month training periods throughout your culinary studies. I was fortunate to do 6 months in the south of France, in Serret, near Perpignan, which is the Catalan region. And then the second stage, which was one of the highlights of my culinary career, I would say, were in Cancale in Brittany, working for a person called Olivier Rollinger, the Maison de Bricourt, that shut its doors about 2 years ago. He basically gave away his Michelin stars, but that was a highlight in my career.
And that's someone who you consider not only a spice master, but really someone that solidified your cooking philosophy.
We became friends very, very fast. I mean, and he, one of the first phrases that he told me is that you cannot learn how to cook. And when I asked how come, and he said, well, cooking is a way of expressing love, some emotions, whether you're in a fast food, it's about satisfying some needs. And the same way you cannot learn how to love, thus you cannot learn how to cook. And I think that really, I went back and started thinking again about why do I do what I do, is basically making people happy, you know, and satisfying people, and thinking that it's very selfish. A lot of the time we create some dishes thinking that somebody else is going to like them without even thinking of who is our a client or who is our, you know, husband, wife, kids, and so on and so forth. And the fact that he chose to stay where he was born in that house in Brittany and, you know, cook with what was around him, but also open up to what was out there, you know. So, and he basically started teaching me about spices and about the history and the trade. And I found it fascinating, yeah. You know, that we take for granted, you know, a jar of 3 ounces of pepper today in a supermarket. There's so much more to it.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the moments when I realized that this is maybe my calling in life.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that he didn't need me in the kitchen after a very short period and asked me to move to the pastry. And was one of the best things that he ever also done for my career is to show me another aspect.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and talk about your transition to New York working for Danielle. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back. Back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Lior Lev Sarkar's Spice Blender. But I also want to give the website. It's La Boite New York, yeah. LABIOTE.
No, OITE.
OITENY.com.
Yeah, La Boite.
I knew I was going to screw that. I pronounced it right. But
or La Boite, as many people.
Yeah, we're going to attempt to correct everybody's French.
Sure, yeah.
But France, you know, moving from the south to Brittany, then there was a big transition overseas to, in 2002, work for Daniel Boulud.
Yeah, after 5 years of living in France, which were amazing, definitely, I wanted to see something else, and I had the opportunity to go and work in New York for Daniel Boulud. So I packed my stuff pretty much and moved to New York in 2002 to work for Daniel. Overall, I spent about 4.5 years at Daniel. I started doing the private events at Daniel, the banquets, what's called. And again, very fast, we developed this friendship and shared a lot of interest of traveling and spices and international cooking. And I was more than fortunate to travel quite a bit with Daniel to do events all over the US and work on some of his cookbooks and food styling and so on and so forth. And
yeah.
So that was also interesting. And I also established a small spice program at Daniel. One of my Christmas gifts was a spice shelf that exists until today at Daniel in the main kitchen.
Yeah, what spice is it?
It hosts about 70 to 80 different spices from all over the world. And basically, I created a small program where cooks could just, you know, go pick up those spices. They have a little bit of reading material about what they are. And every week when I go to do my deliveries at Daniel and I walk into the kitchen and I see the shelf, I think it was a big achievement,
yeah.
You know, to see young cooks that never heard of so many things just going and grabbing things.
So these are single varietals. These are not blends.
Yeah, those are single. We also worked on a few spices and blends and things like that I used until today. And my last 2 and something years there, I was the head chef of his catering company, which was also very interesting, doing about 700.
So that spice rack is, when you're walking out the doors to do service, is to the left?
Yeah. It's the doors that lead to the dining room,
basically,
from the kitchen. So it's a really nice selection of glass jars.
I always find myself, when I'm in that kitchen photographing, up against that corner, not only to be out of the way, but to look at all the spices and read them. And sometimes, sorry, Danielle, you may not know I do this, take them off the shelves and smell and taste. And
so that was my Christmas gift from Monsieur Boulieu.
Excellent. And what were some of the more interesting spices that you feel like you introduced to Danielle in this kitchen?
I think some elements like barberries, like they're used a lot in Persian cuisine, called zereshk, and zuta, which is a wild mint that comes from Israel, also that's very interesting. And at that time, the black garlic was, which was just starting, and today you'll find in many, many different kitchens. Vetiver, which is reserved mainly for the perfume industry.
Yeah, I just know it as the smell of fresh cut grass.
Yeah, yeah. So it's something that throughout those years, one day I got a request from, I don't know if you can mention any brands on this show.
Oh, yeah,
you can
edit
it from Hermès.
Yeah.
To create a lunch menu at Hermès itself with the nose, the person who creates perfumes, around the new perfume that they were launching.
Yeah.
So that was a great experience. We made all these dishes. It was a squab dish with a jus that was made with bois d'Inde, which is sandalwood.
Yeah.
And then a dessert which was made with the vetiver, and a lot of interesting things, and how the perfume industry and the cooking world are so close to one another.
Yeah, extremely intertwined.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But, I mean, obviously there's that difference between tongue and nose.
Yes.
Do you, when you taste spices, is there a specific way you taste them and smell them?
The process of tasting and working around spices, and then on about blends, which is what I do mainly today, is to, first of all, taste. I taste them. I want to see the texture. I want to see the flavor, the visuals, the color, their size, how they're going to crack once they're grind. All of these things tell me a lot, you know, and I heat them up, I chill them, I boil them, I ground them. It's the same way that if you receive a great piece of meat from a farm that you never work with, you'd want to try and get the maximum out of it and know how it could be showcased the best possible way.
This, again, is with just single varietals rather than...
That's to start with, just with a pure single spice. And then from that moment on, we go into the process of making a blend, which is more complex.
Do you remember the first blend that you made?
Yeah, it still exists. It's the Pierre Poivre, which is one of the most, I think we're close to...
Is that the 8 pepper blend?
It's 8/13.
Yeah.
There's, if you will, there's officially 8. There's more than that because we go into different kinds of the same black pepper. It's not only a great blend and one of the best sellers in the last 5 years, but also, I think, a story that resumes what I do.
Yeah. Do you actually have the spice here that we can... Lior was nice enough to bring these beautiful little boxes of all his blends. So, unfortunately, this is not a scratch and sniff radio show, but I'll be trying to do my best to give you little smell notes.
So the Pierre Poivre, if we have a minute about this blend, it's a blend of peppers, like we said, in the idea that I wanted to showcase how peppers are not only about heat, it's about their texture, it's about the scents, the aromas.
Yeah.
It's how it develops once you start eating them. And when we talk about pepper, generally people narrow it down to, you know, black and white. If they have a little bit more knowledge, it's the green and the reds. There are things that are called peppers but aren't, like the pink peppercorn, like kubeb, which are berries.
Yeah.
And my first goal is, I think, like in cooking, is if you can make the best steak or the best omelette, I guess you have it.
You know,
you have that ability. Pierre Gagnier always says that cooking is 3 things, is technique, salt, and pepper. Once you have that, you're good to go.
Yeah.
You know, it's the imagination. So the Pierre Poivre was my omelette, if you will.
How
I can make the most simple blend. And it's named after a gentleman that was called Pierre Poivre. If you translate it to English, it's Peter Pepper. He was born with that name, was a religious person. He was a missionary to the South Asian in the Indies, and was there in Mauritius, and was the governor of Mauritius, and in one of his trips was captured in a naval battle between the Portuguese and the English, and was injured, lost a part of his arm, and was sent to a prison. And once he was released from that prison, since he was also very interested in plants and spices and things like that, either smuggled, we don't really know if he smuggled or just bought them, but brought two plants of clove and nutmeg back to Mauritius and planted them in his garden that exists until today. Again, knowingly or not knowingly, broke by doing so the Dutch and Portuguese monopoly over the spice trade. And if we today have access in a fairly reasonable price to spices, is thanks to Pierre Poivre, who stopped that monopoly. And that was my tribute to, you know, honor that person who is buried in Lyon in a church. I think today really allowed the modern cuisine to have access to spices all over the world.
Well, I mean, it's funny you mentioned monopoly, because this whole time you talking simply about pepper, which is a spice. A lot of people just assume it to pair with salt, but it's a whole other genre in it of its own. And this pepper blend is fantastically green and vibrant and herbaceous at the same time. I mean, it's so fresh, and usually when you smell one, it smells kind of like cigarette buddy, you know, like ashes and just dead. This seems so alive.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the other things that I try to do at La Boite is to educate a little bit, or to bring more awareness that spices are, you know, it's a produce, you know, it grows in a field somewhere on in this planet, you know, it's not made in a factory somewhere in the in the Midwest. There's seasonality. So, for instance, last year was a horrible year for peppers because of a lot of rain and a lot of humidity. So they didn't ripe properly, or they, when they ripe, they became too dusty, or they lost that freshness. So when I receive a shipment of peppers that come from Indonesia or from India, I inspect it the same way that each restaurant owner or chef in the city inspect their delivery. And if it's not up to the standards that I need, I will send it back, because I'm bound to do a great job. I can't do miracles.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you go into anybody's standard cupboard and you can assume that there's been a spice there for years.
Yeah.
Stale, stagnant, lost all its inherent value, but it's still often used. That there is a shelf life to these things as well.
Absolutely. I mean, they will never go bad as far as making you ill or anything like that, but they'll definitely lose their strength or their potential. I would say that if you bought a spice in a jar, I would not keep it for over a year or more than a year. That's why I always encourage people to buy smaller quantities. If you're up to the challenge and buying them whole and grinding them yourself, that's fantastic. But I definitely not expect everybody to do so. So there's nothing wrong with buying ground spices, as long as you know where you bought it from.
Yeah.
Again, the same way that you'll go to the effort of knowing the guy who sell you your tomatoes, meat, or dairy products.
Exactly.
Why don't you know
your spice blender?
Exactly, or your spice store or your spice provider.
Yeah. What's great too is you talk about knowing the person behind it, but it's also knowing the place where these things have come from.
Sure.
You have great blends like the Marrakesh. Though I've never been to Marrakesh, but I know the Crosby, Stills, Nash song very well. Cumin, cinnamon, thyme. It's supposed to be like the marketplaces, kind of that, you know,
the blends,
fervor.
The blends don't have, and it's another thing, they don't have a specific purpose at La Boite Epis. I basically encourage you or anybody else to open a jar, smell it, and tell me what you'd like to do. They have a name that reflects the origin or some sort of an inspiration. The Marrakesh is a tribute to Morocco, of course, and North Africa, although it's very different from one country to the other. And those elements that you mentioned, the cinnamon and the cumin, what's unique about Moroccan cuisine, one of the things is that it combines sweet and savory notes, which the next door neighbors don't, like Tunisia and Egypt and things like that. We talk about North African cuisine, which is like saying American cuisine.
Yeah.
So Moroccan cuisine will combine sweet and savory notes, thus cinnamon, but with cumin.
Yeah, it has a lot of like dried lemon to it too.
So it's a very coarse grind blend. You know, the coriander seeds are left on purpose, are cut in half.
Yeah.
because another element is texture. Once you start eating this Marrakesh blend, I really want another element to, you know, come out front, which is the texture of that blend.
What are some of your more exciting blends to yourself right now? I mean, the Isfahan is something that I know from, I think, Pierre Hermé blends.
Yeah. And the Isfahan is named after the town, the Persian town, and it has dried lemons that also became kind of popular in the last 2 or 3 years. I see more and more people calling me and asking to buy them. It's traditionally used in Persian cuisine for a lot of soups, stews, broth, and it's very floral, very citrus, of course, with those dried lemons. But I chose to add some cardamom and some garlic to give them a little bit more depth. So that's very interesting. And again, you could take that blend and use it for, of course, soups and stews, but make rice dishes. You can make poultry with it, and it's endless, the possibilities. Even seafood.
Talking about the versatility, I mean, some of these have made it in the cocktails, haven't they?
Some of them, yeah. And again, the beautiful thing about those blends is that I see it every day. What a person on the Upper East Side uses for lamb, you have another one in Midtown that makes desserts with them. And there's somebody downtown who makes cocktails with them. So I see these mixologists, I guess that's the new term nowadays, come to the store or call me and say, listen, we're working on this new drink. What can we do? So the same way I've dealt so far with my chef clients is building a blend for a dish. Now we talk about drinks and how, what are the components, what season it is for, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
If you were to put together a Brooklyn blend, what would it consist of?
A Brooklyn blend?
A little bit of concrete, a little bit of...
It really depends who it's for.
Yeah.
And what's the place. One of my next challenges is beers.
Excellent.
Talking about Brooklyn. It's and I have a lot of contacts in the last couple of months from either people who make beer at home or for beer makers that are more, you know, it's more industrial.
Yeah.
And creating something for them.
Excellent. So using hops and using grains?
Using still the spices.
Yeah.
Although we have been talking about cooking with hops a little bit lately.
Yeah.
But using the spices and understanding what's the goal. Where do we want to go? What beer we want to make? And how I can be of help for them. So it's a very interesting challenge.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Excellent. If you've not been to Lior's shop, stop by 11th Avenue and what?
And 51st.
You know, it gets lonely there in Hell's Kitchen. Or check out labroitenewyork.com. That's labroite, labroitenewy.com.
Correct.
Got it right. Yeah. And, see what he's blending up. Know your spice blender. Thank you, Lior, for being on the food scene.
Thank you very much.
Hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. The long-awaited documentary The Vanishing of the Bees will be screening in Astoria, Queens at the Broadway branch of the Queens Public Library on Monday, September 19th. I know that seems like a long ways away, but it isn't. It will be broadcast from 6 to 8 p.m. More information about this fascinating look at bee life and colony collapse disorder can be found at their website at www.vanishingbees.com. I also wanted to add that the producers are all working on a 30-minute educational video for high school students, so any parent or teacher should check out the site to see what he or she can do to work with the team to bring this into a school curriculum. The film has a Facebook page as well that discusses current events that affect bees. This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.